I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. The National Emergencies Act was passed by Congress in 1976 and has been used by all the presidents since that time. President Carter used it to sanction Iran in response to the hostage crisis. President Bush used the act after the September 11th terror attacks. President Obama used the NEA a dozen times, mostly to punish foreign countries. President Trump declared a national emergency last week to get funds not authorized by Congress to pay for his wall along the Mexico border. Here's some of what he said while speaking in the White House Rose Garden.
I could do the wall over a longer period of time. I didn't need to do this, but I'd rather do it much faster. And I don't have to do it for the election. I've already done a lot of wall for the election, 2020.
It didn't take long for state attorneys general, immigration activists, environmentalists, and the House of Representatives to pounce and file suit. What will the courts do, and what does the law say? We asked Stephen Vladeck to join us, and he's a professor of law at the University of Texas Law School. Stephen Vladeck, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
So how does this National Emergencies Act, how does it define what an emergency actually is?
It doesn't. And I think that's one of the most important and awkward things about the statute. Congress, I think, recognizing that it would be somewhat foolhardy to try to anticipate every kind of possible situation that could justify a resort to these special statutory authorities that are unlocked by declaring a national emergency, didn't try to define what an emergency is. Congress just created a series of political and legal checks on the president that haven't really had to work that much over the last 43 years and that haven't been that effective when they've been necessary.
And I'm curious, looking over the last 40 years, has a declaration of emergency by a president ever been challenged the way this one has been?
No, and I think that's part of what's interesting about this case is that, you know, the National Emergencies Act is actually a pretty expansive authority. It gives the president a lot of power to activate over 100 different standby statutes that range on everything from disaster assistance to military construction to financial sanctions. But we've never seen a prior national emergency where the president was, I think, so transparently using the National Emergencies Act as a way to get around the fact that he had asked Congress more specifically for something and had not gotten it. I think that's what's different this time around.
Because Congress supposedly controls the purse strings, right? And this is a kind of a workaround for the president.
Yeah, I mean, I think the separation of powers issue here is murky because on the one hand, Congress, this Congress, did not give the president, you know, anywhere close to the amount of money he had been seeking. On the other hand, Congress in prior statutes has said that when the president declares a national emergency, again, without specifying what that must be, the president can unlock access to, you know, these other pools of money, including, as most relevant here, this military construction pool of money. So, you know, I think it's not quite the sort of a power grab by the president as a matter of his inherent constitutional authority. I think what he's doing is he's taking the older statutes and applying them in a way that they probably were never meant to be applied to get around the fact that the current Congress didn't give him what he wanted.
Let me just quote something from this second law that you just referenced. This is about, quote unquote, I'm reading several different people at the same time here. The White House also invoked a second law. This is from The Guardian that authorized the Secretary of Defense to support the, quote, construction of roads and fences and installation of lighting to block drug smuggling corridors across international boundaries of the United States. So looking at the Defense Department, is there a law that allows the Defense Department to do that?
So there is. I mean, you quoted what Section 1084 of Title 10. There's a separate provision, Section 2808, that allows for the Defense Department to build certain things, but for certain purposes. And I think that's where, you know, the president could run into trouble here. There's no general authority to use military construction funds to do whatever the president wants in a national emergency. Rather, the use of the military construction funds has to be for the use of the armed forces. And, you know, given that we don't usually use the armed forces to patrol our borders, that it's actually Customs and Border Protection, a civilian agency, I actually think that when all these lawsuits, you know, get to the really nub of the matter, it's not going to be the question of whether this really is a national emergency, because courts aren't going to know how to answer that question, given that the statute doesn't define the term. It's going to be about the specific language of these specific authorities, whether the military construction statute really allows the president to take private property along the, say, Texas-Mexico border and build a fence.
So even though, and we played a clip of the president saying essentially, I could do the wall over a longer period of time, both declaring an emergency and then seemingly undeclaring an emergency, you're saying as far as the courts are concerned, that's really a side issue.
Well, I mean, I guess it's not that it's a side issue, it's that it's a harder place to hold the president accountable, right? That is to say, it's easy for all of us to look at what's going on and say, well, this isn't an emergency. The problem is that Congress, for better or for worse, didn't actually define the term. And so I think, you know, the courts, if given a choice between reviewing whether this is really an emergency within the colloquial sense of the term, or looking at the more specific language of the statutes the president's trying to rely upon to see if those fit these circumstances, I think courts are going to lean toward the latter, because I think that's just more consistent with, you know, what courts do. And I think it's also, you know, less likely to tie the hands of future presidents who may confront something we all agree is an emergency, but just not one that Congress could reasonably have contemplated in advance.
Why did Congress pass this law back in 1976? What was the reasoning, or what was the thing that they were reacting to?
Yeah, I mean, one of the ironies is the National Emergencies Act was actually meant to restrain the president. And, you know, today it's being invoked in the other direction. Congress is basically reacting to what had been a very loose practice of declaring national emergencies from World War II, you know, through the end of the 1960s. The idea behind the National Emergencies Act was to regularize the practice, was to require the president to follow certain procedural steps, to give Congress the power for the first time to override and terminate a national emergency. And apparently the House is going to try to set that into motion today. And to sort of basically, you know, make it clearer that a national emergency was a very specific thing that only had specific consequences. I think what Congress did not anticipate in 1976 was that it would become much harder for Congress to terminate a national emergency in the future because of an intervening Supreme Court decision. So when the statute's initially passed, Congress says we can terminate a national emergency anytime we can muster a majority of both houses, whatever the president thinks. But in 1983, the Supreme Court said that kind of legislative veto is actually unconstitutional. So today, Congress actually needs either the president's signature on a bill or veto-proof supermajorities of both houses to override a veto. And I think that's why it's going to be such an uphill battle for Congress to stop this national emergency as opposed to for the courts to do it.
Well, you've got Congress, as you said, the House of Representatives going to do something today. You've got the attorneys general. You've got some people, I think, living along the border. They've got some issues with the wall going up. Who do you think has the strongest case when it comes to a court decision?
And I think the reality is that the folks who are going to have the strongest argument that they should be the ones entitled to challenge this are the property owners who are actually going to see their property either taken or at least built across by the government in order to build the wall. You know, I think some of the states might have a bit of a claim depending upon where the money comes from. And let's keep in mind, I mean, if we're repurposing funds that Congress appropriated for other military construction projects, presumably the folks involved in those projects will have something to complain about if those projects aren't going forward. So, you know, I think we're going to eventually find somebody who is the right person to bring a lawsuit challenging the president's actions. And then I think the focus is going to shift to, you know, whether the courts are going to focus on the question of, is this really an emergency, or whether the courts are going to focus instead on, you know, are the specific authorities the president's using meant to be used the way he's using them?
I mean, it sounds like a collision with eminent domain, right? If someone owns property along the border, that you're saying that they might have more standing than, say, the House of Representatives?
Or at least clearer standing. I mean, so the tricky thing about the House of Representatives having standing is, you know, we don't usually allow institutions to sue because of injuries to their representatives. The question is there some specific injury to the institution as such? It's also part of why it's odd that, you know, you have states not along the border that are part of this lawsuit challenging the emergency. On the other hand, a property owner whose property is going to be taken has, I think, an unquestionable injury and is a very sympathetic plaintiff in this context, regardless of what you think the right answer is to the lawsuits on the merits.
So do you imagine this then dragging on for weeks, months, years as the courts try to sort this out?
Oh, I think so. I mean, I think, you know, here in Texas, we're still litigating over the Secure Fences Act, which was passed back in 2006. So, you know, I think this is going to take longer than it's going to take, it's going to take years more than it's going to take weeks. And I think the real question is going to be just how much the administration pushes the issue, or whether this is really just about the optics of being able to say the president did it, and that, you know, they're not going to fight that hard if they start losing in court. That's really going to drive how long this takes, where we are. You know, are we even settled by the time we get to the 2020 election cycle?
So does that mean then that the money does not go to expanding on the wall along the U.S.-Mexico border until the court decides that money is essentially held in abeyance?
So it depends. I mean, the tricky part is that the president's allowed to act until a court stops him. Now, some of the plaintiffs in some of these cases are seeking what's called an injunction. They're basically asking the courts to stop the president from taking steps toward building the wall and using these funds. It remains to be seen whether courts are actually going to issue injunctions in these cases that will stop the president from acting while the litigation unfolds or not. And one of the big issues, one of the big questions courts look at in that context is, what is the plaintiff's likelihood of success on the merits once we're done litigating this case? So I think, you know, how strong the claims are, which plaintiffs get there first, is going to have a lot to say about what the status quo is going to be while these cases make their way through the courts.
Do you think Congress will begin to rewrite the National Emergencies Act based on what has happened in the last week?
It would sure be nice. I mean, I think one of the things that I hope folks take away from the Trump administration, whatever you think of the president, I think we're seeing a lot of examples of places where Congress has delegated probably more power to the executive branch than we actually would like. And so one of the questions is, how might you reform the National Emergencies Act? I think one proposal Congress ought to take very seriously is have national emergencies sunset so that the president can't just, you know, declare a national emergency and have it go on in perpetuity. Basically, if Congress said a national emergency expires in, say, 30 or 60 days, unless we, Congress, formally pass a statute to approve it, I think that would have exert a lot of pressure on future presidents to not use the National Emergencies Act the way the president is here.
In fact, aren't there emergencies that have been declared decades ago that are still in effect?
Yeah. And I mean, you know, I think most of those are not controversial. I mean, so, for example, there are still national emergencies in place with regard to Iranian sanctions. There's still a national emergency in place with regard to the terrorist attacks on September 11th. We just don't hear about those because those don't feel to us like an abuse of the National Emergencies Act. That's actually why we think Congress passed this regime. And I think, I for one, don't worry that in a world in which the emergency expired every so often, Congress would reauthorize it if it were important enough. But the problem with the lack of a sunset under the current statute is that if the president does what President Trump has done here, which is declare a national emergency that it's quite possible a majority of both houses of Congress don't agree with, There's no mechanism for the majorities in both houses to stop the national emergency unless they can get to a veto-proof supermajority. And at least these days, it's very hard to imagine a veto-proof supermajority in Congress agreeing to anything.
Well, Stephen Vladeck, thanks for explaining this all. Very complicated, but explaining all this to us. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. That's Stephen Vladeck. He's a professor of law at the University of Texas Law School, talking about the National Emergencies Act. After this very short break, we'll be talking about Plessy v. Ferguson, the story behind that Supreme Court decision. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Plessy v. Ferguson, the 1896 law that made racial segregation legal, is considered the most infamous U.S. Supreme Court decision after Dred Scott. The court upheld a Louisiana law that mandated separate train cars for blacks and whites. Homer Plessy, a light-skinned man from New Orleans, bought a first-class ticket, and when asked by the conductor if he was white, said no. He was arrested, and his case made its way to the highest court in a decision that led to segregated housing, schools, bathrooms, water fountains, lines of credit, employment, travel, until 1954 and Brown versus the Board of Education that said separate is inherently unequal. Our guest Steve Luxenburg tells the story of Plessy v. Ferguson in his new book, Separate. He focuses on a number of key players: Plessy's lawyer, Albion Tourge; mixed-race resistors in New Orleans led by Louis Martinet; Justice Henry Billings Brown, who wrote the Plessy decision; and Justice John Harlan, the lone dissenter. Steve Luxenburg is a senior editor for The Washington Post, joining us here in our Philadelphia studio. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for asking me.
I learned a lot reading this book. One, that you say that Jim Crow laws that basically defined what blacks could do in the South really had its roots in the North. Explain that apparent discrepancy.
Well, you know, we think of the South because the South is where separation spread in the 20th century. Notice I use the word separation. Yes. Because in the 19th, they didn't use the word segregation. If you look at newspapers, that's what the word was. But in the South, before the Civil War, there was slavery. You're not separating the enslaved population from the masters, putting them on a – they didn't have many railroad cars in the South anyway because they were lagging behind in construction. So the first separate railroads are in Massachusetts. In 1838, in near Boston, these lines are – there are eight railroads. Three of them – are running separate cars. Only three. So it's already a division.
Right.
We're not having...
And we're talking about freed blacks in the North.
Right. Obviously. So you might think, well, there might be a lot of black passengers. And you would be wrong. The population of Massachusetts in 1840, 1% of the population were people of color. There weren't a lot of black passengers. You didn't need separate cars. In fact, many of them ran empty. But the first... the Eastern Railroad opens up in 1838, and on the first run, there's a newspaper article a month later that refers to two drunken white sailors who are behaving so badly and disgusting the other passengers that they are banished to the refuse as in trash,
right,
or Jim Crow car. And when I ran across this in my digital digging, I was astonished because I think of Jim Crow as a term that comes in the late 19th century.
Right.
But it was used as almost a second reference, as if the crew and the readers would know exactly what was being talked about.
And these cars were also called dirt cars.
Dirt cars.
Forgotten barbarians. And these were the cars where the few blacks in the North were forced to sit as they traveled by train.
Yes. And you know, this is – we have to think about the dawn of the railroad age. This is like a cell phone to us. This is new technology. And as I write in the book – there's nothing like a railroad car to throw together a mass of humanity.
Sure.
No, a stagecoach doesn't do it. It's too small. And people have to ask the question of themselves, where do I sit? And some railroad companies thought their white passengers, they weren't too concerned about their black passengers, would want to sit only with white people.
You describe, and it's interesting, Frederick Douglass makes several appearances in this story, not surprisingly, and he describes being dragged off. Obviously, he was trying to sit in the white car on this train, being dragged off, holding on to the seat while six men pulled him off the train.
And he's holding on so tightly, he claims that he rips the seat off of its hinges or bolts, which may or may not be quite true.
Right.
But here's the situation. This is a political fight, as it often is. Frederick Douglass isn't on the train as just any old passenger. He is the newest agent of the Massachusetts Anti-Slavery Society. He is riding in company with a white abolitionist, and they are going to the meetings of the chapters of the society. And like a lot of our listeners, I suspect, when you go to your night meetings through bad weather, how had the abolitionists been going to their meetings before? Well, they've been going on horseback. So they were thrilled to be on trains. And the conductors were not thrilled on the Eastern Railroad to see Mr. Douglass in company of a white abolitionist. Mm-hmm. So he ordered Douglass to the refuse car, the dirt car, the Jim Crow car. And the white abolitionist said, well, I'll go with him. And the conductor says, no, you can't do that either. Well, the abolitionists were also thrilled because they needed issues. They had one. And so it didn't happen right away. The friction that we're talking about, it actually took 2 years before it began to happen, because Douglass wasn't actually a member of the society's employee staff until 1841. But once they had the issue, they wouldn't let it go.
Well, let's fast forward even past the Civil War and to the South and actually to New Orleans, Louisiana. Louisiana had this law basically segregating its railroad cars.
Huge difference. In 1838, we have a company policy. No law, not required. Fast forward to 1890, and Louisiana is not the first state to enact a separate car, that's not a motor car, that's a rail car, separate car statute. They were preceded by first Florida, then Mississippi, but those statutes were all slightly different. And what this statute in Louisiana did in 1890, which the committee that actually brings this case of mixed race, French-speaking Creoles, Creole being the word for native-born,
right.
What they have protested this law at the legislature. They went to lobby, just like people lobby today. They didn't succeed. And they decide they're going to bring a test case. But what the legislature said, this is in the preamble, is that trains running in the state must have separate, equal but separate cars. Equal but separate
cars.
Cars for white and colored passengers. Not separate but equal cars. It just happens to be a little different phraseology.
Well, you describe, I mean, New Orleans is a kind of a world unto itself even today, but you describe New Orleans after the Civil War, and it was a place of a lot of mixed race people, and also it seemed like a hotbed of resistors as well.
Well, New Orleans is, as you say, unlike any city in the country then, certainly. Mardi Gras makes it unlike any city in the country now. But New Orleans was, when the American takeover occurred in 1803, the provisional governor, a guy from Virginia, arrives. Mm-hmm. And he, to his astonishment, finds that he has 6,000 people, free people of color. Free people of color. And not only are they free under the French and Spanish regimes that had preceded the Americans, but they have a militia and they have weapons. And he writes to James Madison, the Secretary of State, and he says, I got a problem down here. Takes a month for his letter to get there. Takes a month for it to get back. And Madison's answer, like many answers today, is, you're on your own, buddy. I can't direct you from up here in Washington. It would take too long. I wouldn't know what to say. I'm not there. You've got the boots on the ground. And he muddles through. He does not disband the militia. He kind of lets them be who they are. But he is wary of them because if other cities in the South see what's happening in New Orleans, you have the basis for some revolts. So by 1814, when General Jackson comes to New Orleans for the famous Battle of New Orleans, which is at the very end of the War of 1812, he recruits the free people of color to join his ranks because he needs their manpower. And he promises them certain rights, which they don't get. They are promised rights repeatedly throughout the century. And by 1890, they're tired of being promised their rights and not getting them.
In fact, you write that the Emancipation Proclamation did not apply to blacks living in New Orleans?
It did not apply to the enslaved population.
To the enslaved population.
Which, of course, this group wasn't.
Right.
They were the sandwich layer, I call them, between the white population and the enslaved population. But Lincoln changed the draft of the proclamation from September of 1862 to January of 1863 against the wishes of his cabinet to exclude New Orleans and all of the counties along the Mississippi River, which were held by federal troops. And he excluded them because he wanted to be consistent. He was saying to the South, I'm not ending slavery here. I'm preventing you from using the enslaved population to defeat the Union Army. That's what he said he was doing. Now, you can argue about whether that's what he was really doing, but he was trying to be consistent. Well, that creates chaos in New Orleans because you have people streaming into New Orleans who are free in other parts of the state because the Emancipation Proclamation, we should remind our listeners, only applied to the states in rebellion. It did not apply to a slave in Kentucky, because Kentucky had never joined the Confederacy. So in the state where the dissenting justice will come from, John Marshall Harlan, his state, the slave system went on, including in his own family.
Yeah. Let me put a couple of more New Orleans things on the table here. As you said, Louisiana passes a separate car act. Then a committee, I love this name, the Citizens Committee to Test the Constitutionality of the Separate Car Law is organized. There's a guy named Martinet who's involved in this. And eventually there's a young man named Homer Plessy, who's really the person who defies the law. What do we need to know about him? And I know he was light-skinned. Was that sort of his main reason that they chose him?
It was probably the only reason they
really chose. Was he? I was wondering whether he had any civil rights activism that he had done.
He was definitely part of that group and their political activism. But he was young. He was 29 years old. You know, the name of the committee, I laughed when I looked at it. It was on their letterhead. And I thought, well, no PR agency helped them with a logo
no,
here.
But it's a mouthful. It works. It is. But I like it.
It's straightforward. But Plessy was the second of two test cases. And the first one, which we won't go into in any detail, happened. And it didn't quite work out the way they wanted it. They actually sort of won. But it left in place separation on the railroad in Louisiana. It did not leave it in place on railroads running from other parts of the country through Louisiana. And so they needed another volunteer. And the thinking of the legal team, now these are three white lawyers working with Louis Martinet, the mixed race head of the, you know, the engine of the committee. He wasn't technically the head of it. And they decided that it would benefit their argument if they could get someone who could cause confusion, as I write. He was fair-skinned enough to cause confusion. And they wanted to argue that how the heck is a conductor walking down the aisle of a train supposed to separate his passengers when there's a whole group of them that you can't tell the race unless you ask them.
Right.
And they wanted to say, well, he can't ask them because he's not a jury. He can't take testimony. He can't have due process. And so the law should be thrown out as unconstitutional under the 14th Amendment, which required that due process. And they had a very contorted legal argument, a wonderfully complex legal argument for how your race is your reputation and you shouldn't be deprived of it without due process.
Oh, that's fascinating. And the conductor was in on it?
The conductor was in on it. I don't know if the whole train crew was in on it, but the railroad was in on it.
Right.
And why was the railroad?
For civil rights reasons or for business reasons?
I think their civil rights were not as strong as the committees, if they existed at all. No, they're for business reasons. It was expensive to run a separate car. And as we talked about, there weren't a lot of black passengers. So if you could fit everybody into one car, why would you want to run two? Why would you want to own two? Why would you want to own a fleet? Why would you want to own a first-class car when you didn't need one? So they were looking to the future, and they were saying, well, if we don't need to do this, then we'd like to prevent it. But they also thought – they saw the reasonableness of just testing the law. It was a new law. Let's see how far it goes. And so they said, sure. Now, they made very plain to Martinet, we are not going to say this publicly. We are not going to tell anybody that we're in on this. But we're in on it.
Yeah. I thought that was fascinating, something I did not know. Plessy's lawyer is a guy named Albion Tourget. There are many colorful characters in this story. He is as well. What do we need to know about Tourget?
Well, there's probably no more colorful characters than Albion Tourget. He is born in Ohio on what's called the Western Reserve. Western Reserve actually was called that because it was reserved to the state of Connecticut when it was a territory, very, very distant from Connecticut. But it is a hotbed of abolitionists when Tourget is growing up in the 1850s. He is not one of them. His radicalization comes later when he serves in the Civil War, goes to the South, and he emerges from that period. The relationship with his wife, which I describe in detail in the book, is very important to him. She's more progressive than he is at
clearly.
The beginning.
Yes.
And she's pushing him. Like, why aren't you concerned about these issues? But Tourget emerges from the Civil War, and he decides he's going to become what is later, in a degrading way, called a carpetbagger. He's a proud carpetbagger. Yes, exactly what I am. I'm going to come down there, and I'm going to cement the revolution that the Civil War has started. He comes to believe that the North has as much to answer for as the South because he understands the history of racial separation in the North. And he goes to North Carolina. He's basically run out of town after 15 years. Yeah. When he leaves, one newspaper calls him the most hated man in North Carolina, and they're probably right.
He was brash, as you describe him.
Most hated man in North Carolina, in white supremacist circles, certainly.
Yes.
Not in his circles.
Right.
And he goes to the North, and he writes these novels based upon his Reconstruction experience that are so popular and so critically acclaimed that they're compared to Uncle Tom's Cabin, and most people don't know them today. And the first one is called A Fool's Errand by One of the Fools.
And meaning himself.
by himself. And this comes back to haunt him later on because the newspaper, my own newspaper, the Washington Post, says when he shows up for the oral argument, he's just on another fool's errand.
Wow. Wow. And Plessy, I mean, he defies the law on this train. What happens to him after this, and even after this decision, which we will get to? But
well, the committee issued a report in 1897 after it was all over, sort of holding themselves accountable to the public, and they make clear that they don't want the first volunteer or Plessy to spend any time in jail. They were very happy to not have to pursue what's called the habeas corpus route, which is habeas corpus means you're illegally holding somebody in jail. You should let them go because it required Plessy to be in jail. And they didn't want to do that to a volunteer. But they find a way with the help of Judge Ferguson, who rules that the act in Louisiana is constitutional. But with his help, they make it a case that hinges on an error of Judge Ferguson. So that's why it goes to the court as Plessy versus Ferguson. They're suing Ferguson for making an error. And so they get to the court, which isn't easy to do.
No.
And the strategy is brilliant, and then they throw about a kitchen sink worth of arguments against the court, and the court is overwhelmed by them and ignores most of them.
And we will get to that. Let me just throw out Frederick Douglass again. They ask him, I think, to be part of this suit having to do with integrating train cars, and he doesn't really want to be part of it.
Yeah, unfortunately, we don't have any letters from Douglass telling you what he's thinking in his own mind. We have Martinet's letters to Turgay saying what he feels about what Douglass has told them. And, you know, you have to think of it this way. If you are bringing a civil rights case in the 19th century, of course you want Frederick Douglass on your side. He's the most famous black man in America. But it's more than that. In 1883, Martinet happens to be a young delegate to the National Convention of Colored Men, a convention that Douglass called, that was held in Louisiana. And Martinet hears Douglass's stirring speech. I mean, it's really a stirring speech. You can read it in anthologies, saying, "We cannot wait. We must act." And here Martinet is acting. He's acting, and he thinks, of course Douglass is going to be on my side. But Douglass disappoints him. Hmm. Now, my best educated research guess is twofold. One, Douglass saw it as a losing case, and who wants to be on the side of a losing case? And two, these were a bunch of mixed-race people in New Orleans. That's not Douglass's constituency.
Interesting. That's Steve Luxenberg. We're talking about his new book. It's called Separate, The Story of Plessy v. Ferguson and America's Journey from Slavery to Segregation. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with Steve Luxenberg. He's a senior editor at the Washington Post, and he's got a new book. It's about the story behind Plessy v. Ferguson, and the book is called Separate. A question from Hillary. She says, if they couldn't tell Plessy's race without asking him, couldn't he have lied? But the idea was to essentially challenge the law. I mean, he could have lied and said, yeah.
If he was a real passenger, he could have passed for white and then there would have been no case. But the point was he bought a first class ticket and his destination was jail, not Covington, Louisiana.
Right.
He wanted to be arrested.
He wanted to be arrested. So this case then makes its way to the U.S. Supreme Court. What are the arguments that come from Plessy's lawyer?
Well, all the arguments are based in the 13th and 14th Amendments. And those amendments very quickly are the one that abolishes slavery and says that nobody should be in involuntary servitude. That's the 13th. The 14th is the equal protection of under the laws and citizenship rights for blacks and due process. Their job, every lawyer's job, one is to win. So they want to choose arguments that they think might persuade the court. They look at this court and they say, a lot of white men, all white men, obviously, in the 19th century, men of property, men of privilege, men of wealth. Let's make a property right argument. But they need to base it in something, and they base it in the 13th and 14th Amendment, and that's what I mentioned before about race is your property, and you shouldn't be able to have it taken away. I mean, if Plessy can pass for white, why would you not let him do that?
Sure.
Now, it's not a very good argument, because if they had accepted it, what would we have? We'd have one car of white and mixed race passengers and one car of black passengers. So in my view, separation would have survived. So you might have asked, well, Turgay, are you really making a very good argument here?
Mm-hmm.
But he wanted the court to look again and look differently at the 14th Amendment, which the court had already said in previous civil rights cases they were not going to view expansively. That is hard, I think, for us to imagine in the 21st century. We see the 14th Amendment as a bedrock of the American Constitution, which it is today. Right. It was not yet then. And they wanted to see the case in terms of Louisiana's powers and not the powers of Congress or the federal government to extend civil rights throughout the country. So they lose because they can't get the court to accept the 13th and 14th Amendments.
Well, Justice Henry Billings Brown, he writes the Plessy decision, and several things he says. Separation doesn't stamp the colored race with a badge of inferiority. He was trying to say, essentially trying to say separate was equal, when, of course, we know that was not the case.
Well, and those words don't even appear in his decision.
Right, exactly.
Later on, the court uses them in Brown, and that's why we use them today. But Billings Brown is a fascinating character to me because he comes from this abolitionist neck of Western Massachusetts. You would have thought he would have ended up as a dissenter, or at least he would have been a candidate for dissent. But no, he writes the decision. In fact, of the seven justices, it was 7-1. One justice didn't participate. Of those seven justices, six are from northern families.
Yeah.
So it's very much a case where the North is, I think, exhausted by the race question, and they're kind of washing their hands of what's happening in the South.
And didn't want the kind of commingling. I mean, they had these separate train cars in Massachusetts.
Exactly.
Right?
We can't know. There wasn't a poll taken of the justices to know which of them felt that whites were superior to blacks. I suspect all of them felt that way. Now, Harlan felt that way. He says so in his dissent, but he also says that makes no difference. Our Constitution is colorblind, a phrase he picked up from Turgay's brief, and there is no recognition of color when it comes to rights.
This is John Marshall Harlan. He's the lone dissenter. Now, he's an interesting fellow. He's from Kentucky. Slaveholder. He opposed the Confederacy. He also opposed the Emancipation Proclamation, opposed the 13th and 14th Amendments. He opposed the re-election of Abraham Lincoln. And yet he saw something that the other justices didn't see in this case.
Well, he's undergone a remarkable transformation in the 1860s. He ran as a pro-slavery candidate in 1859. His family had been slaveholders. They were not a big farming, slaveholding type of family. This was domestic work that they had their slaves engaged in. But Harlan, by the late 1860s, he's a political guy. He's not a judge. And he recognizes that he has no political future in the Democratic Party because it's filled with the Confederates that he had fought in the Civil War. Now, he joined the Union Army. He raised his own regiment because he wanted to preserve the Union. He felt very strongly about that. He felt equally strongly that slavery should continue.
Yeah.
So he wanted to preserve the Union as it was, the opposite of what Turgay wanted. By 1868, when he joins the Republican Party, he does so because there's nothing else for him. And there he meets Benjamin Bristow, who becomes his law partner. Now, Bristow was the U.S. attorney who was prosecuting Ku Klux Klan members for the violence that they were committing, and violence is very much an undercurrent of this story. He's prosecuting them, and I think that friendship had a great deal of effect upon Harlan. But the most important thing to say is that when he was nominated to the court in 1877, the Republicans rebelled. They said, the Northern Republicans rebelled. They said, this is the best that you can offer us, President Hayes, the new president? You're going to give us a guy from Kentucky who was a former slaveholder? And so Harlan does something extraordinary. He writes a 19-page letter to the Senate Judiciary Committee, which held no hearings in those days, and says, yes, I was pro-slavery, and I'm no longer pro-slavery, and I mean it, and it's genuine, and I am different. And he gets nominated, and he is confirmed.
It's such a fascinating story of someone's evolution, certainly on the
issue. Which should hearten us today, shouldn't it?
Well, I think so, and I do want to get to that. He does talk about the Constitution being colorblind. In law, there can be no superior dominant ruling class of citizens, no caste system here. I mean, it's a very strong opinion, and a lone one, we should say. I'm curious about what the response back in 1896 to this law was when it was passed.
Very little. And the reason is that the newspapers and the public had become used to the civil rights decisions of the Supreme Court starting in 1883. Harlan was the only dissenter in the 1883 civil rights cases. It doesn't have a name like Plessy versus Ferguson because there were five cases consolidated. He was so worried about that dissent that he had writer's block, which his wife helped unlock with a clever little ruse that she claims is the reason why his pen flew. She gave him, Justice Taney, the author of President of Dred Scott, gave him his inkwell.
Used Taney's inkwell to write his dissent for Plessy.
Well, anyway, that decision, that dissent, he had partly created a momentum for its publication because he wasn't finished with it when the court announced his decision. But what they did in this case, in the civil rights cases, was overturn, declare unconstitutional, the Civil Rights Act of 1875, which is just like the Civil Rights Act of 1964. I mean, the radical Republicans in Congress, to use a term familiar today, were woke. They got it. They knew that they needed to not just have these amendments. They needed legislation to implement them, and they put that in the last clause of the 14th Amendment is Congress shall have the right to enact legislation.
Oh, interesting.
So they covered themselves with the Supreme Court. Well, it didn't work. Supreme Court said this law is too expansive. It applies beyond states to individuals and companies. We're not buying it. Well, Harlan dissented in a very ringing dissent. It was published in many, many newspapers in its entirety. It was longer than the majority decision. It took up most of a newspaper page.
Wow.
His dissent in Plessy was published nowhere.
Wow.
Not because they weren't interested. And newspapers in those days, now remember, this is not a Supreme Court press corps standing outside with Twitter and Instagram. They can't transmit the news immediately. And they see this case as maybe worth a third paragraph. Some newspapers put it in a headline. My newspaper did, thank God. But most newspapers didn't. And it took several decades, several more Supreme Court decisions citing Plessy as a precedent for it to be recognized that this was really where separate but equal began.
And does it lead then to just the myriad ways that segregation was applied to housing and schools and water fountains and bathrooms and sitting in the back of the bus?
I say, it's hard to understand because it didn't – I have Google alerts. I get Plessy-related articles. They come and they say things like the Supreme Court established the doctrine of separate but equal and made it the law of the land in the Plessy case. They did no such thing. Now, that's the effect of Plessy.
Right.
It's not wrong to say that. But they didn't do it. And I don't like reading that because I feel like it takes the rest of the country off the hook. Oh, until the Supreme Court established something, there was no separate but equal. But in fact, there had been separation for decades. The Supreme Court are followers, not leaders. They are sanctioning what the country had permitted. And I think that's a very important thing to realize.
But the subtitle of your book is The Story of Plessy v. Ferguson and America's Journey from Slavery to Segregation. I mean, if we've been paying attention, we know our history and how segregation in many ways still exists today.
It absolutely does. And Harlan predicted this. I mean, he saw something that none of the other justices either saw, or if they saw it, they didn't say so, which is that this is going to spread. He did not use all of the examples that you use, but he used several of them. And he said, this ruling will one day be regarded as shameful as Dred Scott. That's pretty prescient.
Yeah, it is. As you say, and even marching then past World War II into the 1950s, that really Brown versus the Board of Education undid what Plessy did?
Well, in Turgay, when he was in the midst of his making his arguments up and making his tallies, he actually tallies up the justices, not by name, but by category, hopeless, likely, on our side. He understood that, the court was changing. He knew that it wasn't going in the right direction. They weren't going to get another justice on their side. But in those days, it wasn't so ideological. It was more party-driven. The president was more interested in making the senators from a state happy with a nominee than they were in packing the court with an ideology. So in Brown, the court recognized, and it was a unanimous decision, that they needed to be clear and unambiguous. And they needed to reverse something. And Plessy was the obvious case to reverse. So they say something in their decision. They, too, say that it Plessy had established a doctrine. So they give us permission to view Plessy in that way. And I think they're right to view it that way, because Plessy is the precedent that, you know, court is all about precedent. We know this. We talk about it. In Plessy, they cite precedents of their own. One of them is right here in Philadelphia.
I was going to say right here in Philly. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. So there was a case involving Mary Miles, a teacher who was like Homer Plessy. She wasn't a volunteer. She was a real passenger. And she wasn't going to sit in the car for black passengers. And she refused to leave the white car. And she was ejected, literally put on the side of the tracks, miles away from her destination. She wasn't even at a station. And she came to a lawyer named George Earle, E-A-R-L-E. He was of good abolitionist stock, a white lawyer. He took her case, and they fail. They go to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, which is three Republicans, so three anti-slavery party Republicans, two Democrats, and they lose 4-1.
Wow.
There's only one dissenter, and that dissenter doesn't file an opinion, so we don't know what he thought. And Agnew, Daniel Agnew, the judge who writes the decision, he makes a ringing case for separation, even saying that he's against promiscuous seating.
Promiscuous seating.
Yes, promiscuous seating.
The idea that people sitting next to each other, something untoward could happen, right?
Yes, and he thinks violence is in the air, and that if you mix the races, it's perfectly appropriate not to mix them, because it's better to stop the violence before it occurs than to try to punish people afterwards.
You mentioned this earlier, that there's nothing more sort of basic than transportation. You know, if you get on a bus, you're going to share it with people. If you get on a train, you're going to share it with people. And thinking about this Plessy case and that it had to do with segregated train cars, thinking about the Green Book, that blacks in the South, they had a Green Book so they knew where it would be safe to have a motel room or to spend the night or where they could have dinner. Thinking, obviously, Rosa Parks, you know, deciding, I am not going to sit in the back of the bus. But something about the sort of basicness of transportation makes it important.
We can't go anywhere without transportation.
Well, exactly.
We can't stay anywhere. So these basic – but, you know, you asked – Plessy opened the door. I think that's a better way to think about it, to every other state in the South to enact its own legislation. It opened the door to companies and institutions enacting policies that would separate people. Separate waiting rooms, separate bathrooms, separate water fountains. Those indelible images that we see, those black and white images, colored white. These are the images that partly drove me to write this book. I mean, when I was in my career as a journalist, I have so often edited and written stories about race. And yet, when I was looking around for a new book topic, I didn't feel I really understood it. And I felt like I needed to understand the roots of racial separation so that I could understand today's arguments over race. Because this case, I think, reverberates down through. If you look at statistics of the gap between white and black wealth, white and black housing patterns, white and black education, there's still a huge gap.
And you think Plessy helps us understand
that? I think Plessy helped create it.
Create it.
It's very difficult to catch up. I mean, President Johnson, when he gave a speech about the Voting Rights Act of 1965, he talked about a starting line. But, you know, you can remove the shackles of slavery, but you don't necessarily – you can't end all of the oppression that has happened beforehand. It has made you start way back from the starting line. So I feel like we do need to understand that this is a compelling story, I feel, that needs to be told today. And, you know, it reminds us that racial progress in America is never comes swiftly or easily.
No. Or a straight line or anything related to that.
And straight lines in transportation or in race.
Well, on that note, Steve Luxenberg, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Well, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. He's a senior editor for The Washington Post, and we've been talking about his new book called Separate, The Story of Plessy v. Ferguson and America's Journey from Slavery to Segregation. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you for joining us.